Hello, this is Andrew Heaton, and you're listening to The Reason Podcast. You can subscribe to us on iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. The Reason Podcast is where I speak with Reason senior editors Nick Gillespie, Catherine Mangue Ward, and Matt Welch. Today we're going to discuss the GOP Civil War, three ex-presidents coming out to talk about Trump and the budget, but before that, the scandal du jour, which is the Kelly phone call regarding slain soldiers. Earlier this month, four soldiers were killed in Niger, and before they were repatriated to the United States, Trump was already under fire from various quarters for not having called to comfort their families, which is apparently a somewhat standard practice for presidents, although I don't know the frequency of it. He went on to do a press conference specifically calling out his predecessors and Obama and saying that they didn't tend to call the families of slain soldiers, which brought about criticism from various ends. He then called one of these families with a congresswoman in the car of the family he was talking to, who reported that the phone call was fairly flippant and offensive, and the widow has also come out and said that. All of this brought about John Kelly, the former general and chief of staff in the White House, holding a press conference and talking about how he was astonished that this issue has become politicized, and in fact, that seems to be what's happened. Before we kind of get into the decorum of how all parties should be acting on this, one of the things that I'm intrigued by is that the event that led to all of this in Niger with servicemen dying is being likened to Trump's Benghazi by some of the Democrats. So, Nick, I wanted to ask you, is that a fair representation of this military action?
Well, you know, I think the key here is that this incident wraps up one of the major problems with the Trump administration or with the Trump presidency, rather, and both how he acts as well as his opponents act, which is we've skipped already from talking about the four dead soldiers in Niger to talking about whether or not Trump has good manners. And to me, as somebody who is neither a Trump loyalist nor a reflexive Trump hater, I care much, much more about why we are in Niger to begin with. And we've already skipped over that because now we're talking about whether or not the president calls everybody who dies in combat. John Kelly, his son, was killed in combat. And the president, he went out of his way in his remarks about Trump to note that Obama did not call him, which is part of where this controversy is coming from. But the larger question is, what are we doing in Africa? We have in Niger, we've had a presence through Operation Flintlock, which started in 2005, which is actually based in Nigeria, but now we're building more stuff in Niger. And that's to go after Boko Haram and a couple of other terrorist groups and to train people as well as go after terrorists there. That's the real question that we need to be having or the real conversation that we need to be having. So I see in this, it's Benghazi only in this sense, which is that Benghazi was a way not to talk about basic foreign policy questions. It was a way of making trying to get partisan advantage over a military fuck up. And, the fuck up here is not necessarily Trump calling. By all accounts, the president doesn't call every family. But the real fuck up is, what are we doing there? And the more soldiers we have stationed in more places around the world doing things that should be done by local governments, in local states, this is going to happen again and again. And we still, we're, 17 years into the 21st century. We haven't even formulated a post-Soviet foreign policy worth a damn, much less explain why four guys are getting killed.
I had no idea that presidents usually called or even somewhat regularly called families of fallen soldiers. Is that a standard practice? And does that start with, I'm guessing, Vietnam? Catherine, I know that you've not been president yet, but when you become president, is this going to be what you do?
I mean, I think it's a weird idea that this is somehow should be on the president's to-do list. I get the symbolic import of it, but and I like, I guess, that it confronts the president with the fact that actual real human beings with parents or spouses are dying under his orders. At the same time, it's clearly theater. I mean, this is a thing that advice columnists are always advising people against, where you're not supposed to call people if what you're looking for is to make yourself feel better, not to make them feel better, to apologize for your past sins. And this smacks of that to me a little bit. I found Kelly's remarks actually incredibly moving as someone who thinks that the underlying ideas of those remarks are pernicious and wrong. The idea that this, you know, the people who serve feel a little bit bad for those of us who don't because we can't understand the sort of power of martial courage and all these kinds of things. I think that's absolutely the wrong way to run a modern country. And yet, he was very compelling and he was very dramatic in his remarks. At the same time, I worry that this is all just sort of political theater, and ultimately, I feel pretty cynical about it.
Well, do you agree, Catherine, that when he said that the Congresswoman Wilson had politicized this moment, because part of this is weird. I mean, that they the Congresswoman from Florida was driving in a car with the widow when Trump called, and the widow put Trump on speakerphone. And Trump said that, you know, I mean, the bone of contention is partly that Trump said that, you know, he knew what he signed up for, et cetera, that like the content of the call was bad.
I mean,
is it even worth getting into the content of the call, or is Kelly right that this got politicized in a way that it shouldn't have?
I think it absolutely did get politicized, but everybody was politicizing it, right? The congresswoman was, Trump was, Kelly is. You know, the very act of war is a political act. Like, I'm not sure why we would trace the original sin to some sentence in that call when it's clear that the broader original sin is like the existence of the nation state or something. I mean, it's the idea that somehow this one congresswoman is the one who tipped it over, or Trump is the one who tipped it over, seems silly to me.
Well, the reason that this became a news cycle starting from about 10 days ago was when first journalists asked President Trump about his etiquette, manners, practices about calling fallen foreign military service members. And then he responded, as Trump often narcissistically and braggadociously, saying that he does it. He calls people more than his predecessors, including Obama, ever did. And so this then just became a thing. So this is all a cycle of dumb media tragedy emanating since then. He roped in Kelly on a couple of occasions, including that one. So this is why we're talking about it. Is like a lot of other things in 9 months of Trump presidency, it starts with him making an impetuously stupid remark that speaks to his not just lack of manners, but his just sort of fundamental narcissism. And so the media, which is ready to jump on every single one of those things because that is so much more interesting than substance of the underlying policy, and then off we go. I think that there's a couple of important comparisons to Benghazi, both in terms of overlapping and then not. Frederick Wilson, I was on Al Sharpton's show on Sunday. They're like, this is it. This is the Benghazi. The way that they are using Benghazi is this might be our way to have 3 or 4 years worth of increasingly grandstanding hearings on Capitol Hill as a political thing. That's their definition of Benghazi. Nick is right in the definition of Benghazi. It prompts a question, and Ed Krajewski wrote about this on our site. Like, the similarities are, what the hell are we doing there? In the case of Benghazi, which is in Libya, we were there because we toppled an existing state and then kind of had no plan B afterwards. So that's an entire set of questions. And it speaks very directly to one of the worst foreign policy disasters in the Obama presidency, one that Hillary Clinton was describing on the campaign trail as smart power at its best, which it just absolutely was not. In Niger, which I'm really, really trying to pronounce correctly because my brain wants to say Niger every single time, this is one of most of every country in Africa at this point where we have special forces and we're not toppling a dictator. We just got these boots that are on the ground, but we don't call them boots on the ground because they're special forces, and somehow that's different. We haven't had any conversation about that as a country, and yet this is the default setting, Republican or Democrat, going forward. That's what we need to talk about. And the existing lack of authorizations of use of military force associated with them. Under what auspices do we have military personnel involved in potentially deadly conflict in all kinds of countries that aren't even on the list of the 7 that we're currently bombing?
we're building out in Africa, including Niger, a presence. It's not even like, Trump forgot about these. I was kind of appalled to see a bunch of, Rachel Maddow had tweeted about or talked about how, Trump, why were troops there in the first place? And she has a background in foreign policy or political science. And then some right wingers were like, because Obama put them there during his presidency. But in fact, it goes back to 2005. And again, Matt, I think you're absolutely right that, like, to the extent we are mired in two wars, at least, and I guess more than that, which we're not getting any, we're not having any discussion about that. Like, what our exit strategy from Afghanistan? How do we know that we've lost so that we can exit? We haven't defined basic terms in Afghanistan or Iraq at this point. We're already expanding presence into Syria. We've got like a whole new structure for Central Command in Africa. And there's like no discussion. I mean, in the media, I guess politicians don't want to talk about it for reasons that you've written about, that, actually limiting the presidential power would mean that Congress had to actually step up and do its job. And beyond Rand Paul, and he's about it, in the Senate anyway, there's nobody who's interested in doing that. But, we, at least in the media, we should be having this conversation about what the fuck are we doing in these places where people, the more bases you have, the more soldiers you have floating around the world, and they're going to be killed. And this is, it's insane. It's horrible to the families, of course, but it's also, it's just a total tripwire for the country to get embroiled in all sorts of, elective wars, or as Obama might call them, stupid wars.
And just to add on to that, there, in foreign policy circles, there is the widespread of intellectual belief that Trump turned his back on Africa, that we're doing too little there. I was at a fundraiser for Jeff Flake this past week in D.C., and mostly libertarian crowd, almost every libertarian organization had somebody there. And one of the questions were, like, are you concerned about how Trump has turned his back on Africa and we've kind of withdrawn from there? And Flake, to his credit, flipped the script and said that we need authorizations of use of military force where we have the military. But even in a libertarian circle of people who pay attention to foreign policy, there's the notion of like, we're giving up Africa to the red Chinese, and that's a bad thing. We just don't talk about this. We're running on some amount of autopilot.
Is that the threat of that? We've been reading for decades now accounts of how China is essentially building the infrastructure of Africa as it emerges from poverty. I mean, it's had enormous economic growth as a continent over the past 10, 15 years. Is that the real threat, Matt, that China is both populating the country, but they're paying for and literally building the infrastructure, so they're going to have more access to African markets?
Yeah, there's I would say there's three main areas of critique. That's one. Another one is there's a rising, there's famines all over the place, there's instability, there's Islamic movements, and so there's kind of that hawkish thing. And then there's just sort of the fragile democracies and civil societies. And that story is actually a pretty good story. And I would argue that the red Chinese are not automatically a net negative on that. If they want to build, an infrastructure there, good. Infrastructure needs to be built. That's great if they feel like doing that. But a lot of it is just this inchoate sense that we can't have someone else in the world who's as interested in it as we are. What happens if China takes, more assertive stances in the South China Sea? Wow, that's terrible. It's the South China Sea. It's not the South. Oh, it's not the South Californian Sea. And I get that China is not a particularly friendly country to especially its neighbors in its region. And there's reasons to be on guard about it and cybersecurity and all that kind of stuff. But there's this you could feel the existential dread. We don't want to face facts that we're just another country, and in the words of John Lydon. And so we hold on to it, even though there's no strategy associated to it. We just feel the sense of impending loss. And I think that's juvenile, and we need to confront it.
Right. If our definition of winning in the world is that we always spend more money, we always have more troops, we always have more active diplomatic relations, then that winning is also losing, right? If China can't build a road in anywhere in an entire continent without us saying this is a sign of the decline of America, we need to think again about what the decline of America really means.
Well, it sounds like Starship Troopers, doesn't it? Like wherever the bugs are going to be, we need to be there first or fighting them back. So now we're scrambling for Africa in a 21st century version. Yeah, it's nuts, and it's totally thoughtless, and no attention is being paid to costs or benefits.
Hey, Matt, I want to go back a moment to something you said about the South China Sea. A lot of the rhetoric around sort of U.S. global hegemony is that, well, we need to have a naval presence to keep shipping lanes open. And we need to be able to make sure the United States is kind of the main force in terms of international shipping in the South China Sea and that kind of thing. I would infer that you would kind of push back on that reasoning, that we don't necessarily need to be the primary force in terms of keeping trade routes open and that sort of thing.
Can we put a degree of difficulty multiplier on this? You are not allowed to invoke the Admiral or the Commodore, your ancestor.
Yes, I'll try. What I will do instead of answering the question directly is do what people who invoke that principle never do themselves, which is to confess to their own ignorance and or to explain exactly what they mean. We have used this phrase, we must keep the world shipping lanes open and free for trade, for decades, many, many, many decades. I have yet to hear anyone spell out what exactly that means. Which shipping lane would suddenly not be free for trade if we weren't in it? Is it the Strait of Hormuz? It might be. But people never say, it's a thing, it's a cliche that people say without ever really wanting to elucidate what it is. I don't doubt that it is possible that if we withdrew from the South China Sea in a meaningful way, that suddenly China's military, Navy, would be seizing trade ships. Seems crazy. Seems like it might be a violation of the WTO, just thinking out loud here. But it's possible. I'm opening up my mind to the possibility. But those people who've been arguing this forever, I think, need to explain how, rather than just to assume the default of like, oh, yes, it must be true. People are incentivized to keep trade flows open everywhere because that's the best way for poor countries to stop being poor. So who is it? The Somali pirates? Okay, let's do that one. let's have the Navy there. Does that mean the Navy has to be in every single goddamn pinch of water? I really, really doubt it. I'm open to evidence, but we never hear it. We just hear the cliche.
Okay, guys, you heard it from Matt. He's pro-pirate and anti-trade. That's the position he's going to die on.
No, you misunderstand me. If the pirates are the problem in Somalia, I'm saying I'm going to violate the non-aggression principle or something here and say it's okay to put a destroyer in there and say, go to hell, pirates. All right. But I need some evidence.
Do you think on this, here's an idea that, the discussion about the shipping lanes, like the discussion about having to have a presence in Africa is, let's say it is a lagging indicator, or it arises from anxiety about America being decentered as the essential nation or the only country that matters. And I think we would probably all push back against, the idea that America has to be everywhere, obviously, but also that we can afford to be everywhere. But given all of that and Trump's Make America Great Again, would he be worse? I mean, like, what would Hillary be doing in these situations? Would she be worse? Shortly before he took office, I talked with Thad Russell, the historian who runs the Renegade University Online. And he said that he thought, in terms of foreign policy, Trump would be worse in the Middle East because he's kind of racist and kind of dumb, and he would bomb the shit out, I guess, as he claimed to, he would bomb the shit out of the Middle East. But that compared to Hillary, who has a whole filled out worldview that is about kind of a Wilsonian projection of American democracy everywhere, that Trump in the long run, would be less deleterious to American, he would use less force around the world. Do you guys agree with that? Or is that what we're seeing playing out? Or is this more of a problem if people cast the need for a bigger and bigger American military, which Trump totally supports, you know, in terms of keeping America great? I mean, are they playing Trump in a way that will make him even worse than Hillary would have been?
I just think it's too mixed and too early. The thing that Trump is unambiguously worse than Hillary, even though she tacked insincerely in this direction during her campaign under pressure from her primary opponent, Bernie Sanders, is on international trade. He has 19th century views on economics, generally speaking, and trade. Hillary Clinton doesn't. She will pretend to. She thought she could get away with the same thing that Obama did before her, and that presidents, especially modern Democratic presidents, tend to do, which is to be anti-trade in on the campaign trail, and then let everything keep going once they govern. That's an important way. We know what the result of North Korea, strategic impatience is going to be. It could be that it all turns out for the better. It could be that Japan learns to take self-defense seriously enough that they shoot down rockets that are over their own airspace, and that freaks out North Korea and people start negotiating with China. Whatever. We don't know. Whereas Hillary Clinton was less blustery towards North Korea specifically. Then at the same time, I'm not sure I agree with that. I think Hillary Clinton was much more likely she really does think that Libya was an example, and she was obviously in favor of the Iraq war. So I think that she would be as likely to commit ground troops and to commit to nation building in places. I don't think Trump's ever going to start a new nation building thing in a serious way. He's just going to not end it, which is really problematic, like in Afghanistan. Then just to throw one last curveball in there, Trump to have kind of a Monroe Doctrine feel, where he's like, oh, you know, Russia can have its spheres of influence, other people can have theirs, but ours is Cuba and Venezuela. And he's talked in ways about both of those countries, which are shitbag socialist countries that are failing, I think, right and proper to associate yourself with the people who are fighting against those tyrannies. But he's talked in language that suggests that he feels that we could send the gunboats there just like we did for a century before the end of the Cold War. And I think he's much more likely to go in that direction than a Hillary Clinton would have been. So I think it's just a mixed bag.
I also think with the difference between Trump and Clinton, that what we would see is the same thing in almost all areas of their presidency, which is to say Hillary would slowly, calmly, inexorably grow the American military presence in lots and lots of places all over the world, in a very low variance way, right? There would be a little more here, a little more there. Everything would be sort of negotiated and sort of telegraphed in a way that is aimed at mostly increasing American influence while minimizing the disruption to stability. Trump is high variance. So, the question isn't sort of will America's role in the world be bigger or more damaging or more intrusive? There'll be one big flare-up or two big flare-ups under Trump that are extremely hard to predict, that wouldn't have happened under Hillary Clinton, but Hillary Clinton would have left 8 years in the presidency with, I suspect, a dramatically increased military budget, certainly a dramatically increased military presence in a variety of places that lend themselves to this kind of low-key, Niger-style meddling below the radar of both the American public and Congress. And yes, I'm going to pronounce it Niger, goddammit. And that would be true of her domestic policy as well. Just as with Trump, you know, you wake up every morning and you're like, what are we doing today? And it could be bad and it could be good, but the point is you don't know.
Yeah, I think looking back at the 2016 election, you had Hillary Clinton, who is an articulate war hawk, and you have Trump, who is a bombastic isolationist. So rhetorically, he's terrible, but in terms of getting into new conflicts, he appears to be good based on his campaign positions. But I think the moment that we actually do get attacked by someone in any significant capacity or just in any media capacity, that he's likely to be a lot more reflexively militant than he has been previously.
Just quickly, not an isolationist, Andrew. That's far too strong. I mean, I would put him as more of a Jacksonian type, where he's specifically belligerent,
an angry mercantilist.
He was like, let's bomb the shit out of them and take their oil. He didn't run entirely as an isolationist. He did run against Bush's disastrous wars and a few other things besides. So I think it's somewhere in between. Go on.
Yeah, and I'm also prescribing to him a coherent foreign policy position, which I don't think he espoused at any point during the campaign. It was kind of whatever you wanted it to be at that exact time, plus some inflammatory comments. I want to stop there in terms of the sort of broad strokes of Trump on foreign policy and move on to some former presidents, because several of them all weighed in on the current era last week. Barack Obama broke 9 months of silence by saying, we've got folks who demonize people and rile up their base. This is probably a reference to Trump for short-term tactical advantage. And you had George W. Bush, who has been fairly quiet since his presidency. I don't think he's really done much campaigning or particularly commentary on what's been going on during the Obama years. But he came out in New York last week and had a speech that was criticizing the rise of nationalism and nativism and isolationism and the apparent return to bigotry and white supremacy. And as with Obama, he did not specifically call out Trump, but it certainly appeared that he was implicating him in this decline. And then, interestingly, you had Jimmy Carter pop up via a Maureen Dowd interview where he kind of came off as sympathetic to Donald Trump and offered to go to North Korea as part of a presidential envoy to try and lessen the tensions over there. Catherine, I want to push this to you, at least initially with Jimmy Carter. Do you think Jimmy Carter is right in saying that Trump gets a raw deal from the media?
I think that all presidents, when they are talking about the current president, are really talking about themselves. And that kind of narcissism is what leads you to think you can be president in the first place, be president for a while, and then think about yourself afterwards. So I guess I read his remarks through the lens of, you know, Jimmy Carter got a pretty raw deal from the media, and people were arguably unfair to him based on certain things that they attributed to his character. Also, though, and I say this with as much respect as I can muster for a former president, he's pretty old. I'm not sure, you know.
93.
I wouldn't read so much into it, I guess. I thought Obama's remarks and George W.'s remarks were both very, very pointed, very clearly. You know, I love the idea that these guys like have some kind of super secret, you know, WhatsApp thread or something where they're just like,
they've got an AOL chat board fucking, they're still using.
Fuck. Yeah. No, I mean, you know, WhatsApp's pretty secure. I think I hope they use that.
Well, AOL is shut down, but, right? Instant messaging. So I don't know how they're talking to each other now.
That's true. But I imagine that there's some venue in which these people talk to each other. And you know, I think that the wheels of that rightly should move very slowly. But to sort of gently say, hey, just FYI, we former presidents think this is a little off kilter is probably about the right thing.
You know what's amazing? Pew Research recently, they update a general survey every year around this year. And the two things that they're really kind of pumping from the latest iteration of this is that the partisan gap on almost everything has massively increased, so that, you know, say even 10 years ago or 5 years ago, because the takeoff really starts in 2004, but it starts there, but it jacks up in like around 2011, 2012. So that, you know, Republicans and Democrats hate each other more than they've ever done. Like, you know, people who are Republicans or Democrats say they don't trust the other party in equal measures, like 80% don't like the other party. They think they're bad. One of the things that's buried in that, though, is that people think that racism is worse now than it was in America 10 years ago, 20 years ago and things like that. And, you know, I mean, is that accurate? Like, you know, can, you know, 330 million Americans be wrong? And if so, it predates Trump in a way, you know, and so it's like, is he an effect of it? Is he a cause? And obviously he's probably a little bit of both. But what is driving that? Because I have to say, you know, like on a, you know, I wouldn't have said that race relations or that, you know, that racism has gotten worse over the past decade. It seems to me that it's gotten better, but what do I know, right, in terms of that?
Well, I mean, it's hard to see the rise of the birther movement in particular as anything but a kind of crystallized version of othering someone. And the othering maybe has a racial component, maybe has just like an Alinsky component, a community organizer component. It's complex. And I'm you know, one of the last people to stand up and say, well, that thing or that person is racist, because it's just hard to measure. And I think it gets to an unhelpful place discussion wise almost immediately if you're interested in the art of persuasion rather than just sort of walling people off and declaring the people on the other side of the wall as to be irredeemable on some level. But I think we have more racial discourse, like more racial conflict in discourse quite obviously than we did 10 years ago. I mean, I remember Michael Moynihan wrote a piece for us right around the election in 2008, might have been a little bit afterwards, where he was sort of assessing the modern state of kind of black racial academic discussion there. And you know, what is back then, Obama was not authentically black, according to some people. And what does it mean that this sort of mixed character comes through, and how that's reflected in it? And his take was very optimistic of like, we've gone to an area where we've decided to embrace complexity. We've decided to create these multiple hyphenations on the Census Bureau, and people are enthusiastically choosing those rather than tribal identities. And boy, that does that feel like an artifact from a different time. That's just not how things played out. I thought that the Bush speech in particular had some pretty interesting nuggets. And I would throw in this whole category of speeches last week, the John McCain speech too from Monday, where he talked about spurious nationalism. Nick wrote about that on the site. All these speeches, very interesting. Bush in particular had two great lines that we're thinking about, I think, just in general. One is a line saying that we too often assume the worst in people who we're disagreeing with politically, while at the same time assuming that we can be measured by our best intentions. I think there's a lot of wisdom in there, and a lot of the dumb conflict that we see on a minute-by-minute basis on Twitter and elsewhere is sort of baked into that. And he also said, and I think he's completely right about this, that in a time when top-down politics is kind of grotesque, it's particularly important for the mediating civic institutions out there to stand up and be better at what they do. The little platoons, all the stuff that makes America, need to step up, and we need to have a renewed appreciation of that. I like all that. I think he's completely right, and he was eloquently so. The thing that I think all three of us, or all four of us, can agree on is that while you're sitting there nodding and saying yes and yes, and I'm kind of glad that they did this in these parlous times, I want to see some self-reflection from these sons of bitches. You know, George W. Bush was talking in his speech about how we're turning our back on the world, and that turn your back, that's when you unleash chaos. Like, well, there's other ways to unleash chaos in the world, from what I can remember in 21st century history. The elites shit the bed. They just did. They need to own that, including in the Obama sense. He's like, oh, we're using divisive rhetoric. Oh, really? You think we're using divisive rhetoric? That's interesting. I remember your presidency, too. I want a sense from those people that they want to bring manners back to D.C., that part of those manners is more than just manners, that it's actually about policy, including the honesty of saying, I cocked up. I screwed up. I made this place worse and made it more likely that a politics that I find repulsive would win out. And so now I'm coming back and saying, look, I screwed up, and let's have that conversation. And we haven't heard that yet from these people.
I think this underlying point also about attributing the worst to your enemies and the best to yourself is something that Bush could easily have said during the Obama administration, right? I mean, you know, his ongoing themes in every single one of his major speeches, which was essentially, listen, I am opening my hand, I am reaching out, I want to reach across the aisle, and all you have to do is agree with me about everything, and then we can be good. You know, then we can really make some progress forward. And, you know, Trump has basically flipped that and just said, look, everyone disagrees with me except for my guys, except for my voters, and I'm constantly under siege, and that's how it's always going to be. But both of those, you know, both of those positions reflect the kind of underlying lack of credit given to people who are disagreeing with you. And you know, Bush is right. a sentence I say all the time. Bush is right that is poisonous in politics, though the implied golden ageism about his own term, I guess, or about everyone's term before Donald Trump's, I'm not sure which is ridiculous since no such golden age existed.
Well, you know, it is kind of fascinating. I hadn't thought about it in this way until you guys started talking about it. But all of Bush's major accomplishments, and you know, they were not good ones, but they were bipartisan. When you think about the Medicare prescription drug expansion, when you think about No Child Left Behind, when you think about the authorization of use of military force, both in Afghanistan, obviously, and the Patriot Act as well, but then also in Iraq. And you talk about the bailouts, the auto bailout and the financial crisis. He actually did govern ultimately and to the country's deep debilitation in a very bipartisan manner in a way that Obama did.
That's
not.
Right. I mean, George W. Bush is definitely the person who taught me to hate bipartisanship, because that's what you get. Well done, sort of last gasp of WASP civility in American politics, bipartisan project building, and also sort of reactive action in the face of catastrophe. It's just like a litany of some of the worst policies we've enacted in recent memory.
Although it is fascinating, if I can just dilate on one thing, because I actually lived in Texas when Bush was governor for a couple of years from 96 to 98. And he had, and this also was true of Rick Perry, and I think it might also be true of Greg Abbott, but I don't know. But, you know, Bush in Texas was able to pull upwards of 40% or more of the Hispanic vote in Texas. And in his reelection in 2004, he got there are various estimates of the exit polling of Latinos, but he got between 40 and about 45% of the Latino vote, which is stunning for Republicans, because people like, McCain and Mitt Romney, just did horribly against that, as did Trump, although he did a little bit better than Romney. And so it's odd, if we're talking about racial polarization and, along with, bipartisan hate or, hatred of partisan along partisan lines, there's something Bush is kind of an interesting character. And maybe it's, I don't know what you do with any of that, but it's kind of interesting. He's the last Republican who had any rapport, national Republican, with an ethnic minority group.
That kind of makes sense, though, right? Because, one of the only language which he would coherently speak without stuttering or weird things was Spanish. So he was more articulate with that. But beyond that, on a policy level, he was in favor of immigration reform, wasn't he? Like, that was he wanted to give worker permits to people coming into the United States. So he wouldn't have really had a bone to pick with Mexicans, right?
No, in fact, he was in sharp contrast on the national stage in the 1990s with California. I mean, people are perennially comparing the two states. In modern thinking, it's like, oh, Texas is the red state model, California is the blue state. Well, in the 1990s, California was the xenophobic anti-immigration model, and under Pete Wilson, and George W. Bush was the open arms, let's have trade and immigration model. We forget, and it seems kind of crazy even to think about that, but that's 23 years ago. It's not that long ago, and it was part of the reason why I was actually very hopeful for George W. Bush as a candidate in 1999, because of that contrast. He, like his father and like Ronald Reagan, had a very kind of open understanding of the benefits of immigration and the personal stories, and that people who end up becoming illegal immigrants or are illegal to begin with, oftentimes it's not really an issue of criminality. It's just an issue of the law putting them on the outside of it. Maybe we should change the law. And that was central to his identity in the 1990s.
We need to start talking about the World Series, Matt, in terms of the future country then. I am not looking forward to, the Astros versus the Dodgers, but that actually is, that makes it almost like the Olympics. This is like the Cold War.
That's right.
Between the two major states.
Hey, Nick, so I'm curious, with George W. Bush, he left with, historically low low favorability, but he seems to be coming around a little bit in the public consciousness, if nothing else, just contrasted with Trump.
It's the paintings. It's the paintings.
He's really
his art's warm. He's like the Thomas Kincaid, of our time.
Do presidents usually recover by the, like, Nixon never did, right? Like, no one's really raring for Nixon.
Nixon totally recovered. Are you kidding?
He was really? Like,
there were times where people wouldn't even say his name, you know, or mention it. And, you know, then suddenly he was talking to every president. Clinton talked to him on the phone a lot. And, I mean, Nixon was rehabilitated. And if Nixon could be rehabilitated, then, you know, Bush merely destroying the economy, blowing out the budget, and putting us in wars without end, you know, it's like,
he could totally pull that back.
Yeah,
just use some of that folksy charm and don't immediately try and incinerate all of your opponents on Twitter, and he might be able to pull it off.
I want to see, you know, there's those paintings which are truly awful. And I mean, they're sub-poker playing dog things where there's like the all the Democratic presidents of the 20th century playing pool. And then I think they're playing pool and the Republicans are playing cards, or it might be vice versa, because Roosevelt probably would need a special bridge on the pool table. You know, what we need now is we need one of those portraits where it's, you know, the Republicans and Democratic presidents. I don't know what they would be doing. Maybe a Lindy England kind of, you know, thumbs up at a human pyramid in Abu Ghraib or something. But that's the painting that George Bush needs to make to bring the country back together.
But before we move on to a different topic, Catherine, if you can have a drink with any living ex-president, who would you want to hang out with? What would you want to talk to him about?
Oh, God, can I just pass?
Yeah, I'll tell you what I would do. I'd want to hang out with George H.W. Bush. He seems like a nice guy. And I feel like his guard would probably be down in terms of discussing security matters. So, I'd ask him about Roswell and stuff.
The correct answer to that question is George W. Bush, because he's a teetotaler. So, you'd want to be the one to be
there
to break the ice.
He's the designated driver.
I want to see him get slurry.
That'd
again.
Be great.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. Do I get to force them to drink? Because that's a kind of a different question. No, I actually,
Catherine, that answers so much, Catherine. Your question answers exactly where you'll be going.
I would totally drink with Jimmy Carter, and it's not least because I would want to plumb the depths of his secret libertarianism, which is an emerging narrative.
Wait, what?
I know. It's an emerging narrative amongst people who know about things.
If he still had lust in his heart. And this is like, now I feel
just because I said plumb the depths doesn't mean we had to go there. But yeah, no, I think, you know, the fact that he deregulated.
But Matt, do you feel like a dinosaur? Like we're citing things from our childhood that clearly the younger generation has no idea what we're talking about.
I know lust in his heart.
I saw today a headline, or maybe Andrew had passed it around, but like Jimmy Carter has lust in his heart for like a North Korea solution. Like, all right, so it's still passing. That's a Bob Shearer special.
Did you guys know the Astros used to be in the National League, you know, and a Hershey bar was a dollar?
All right.
Wow.
Moving Catherine on.
I just want to talk about deregulation.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry, Catherine, before we move on, what is this? What is this Jimmy Carter libertarianism? I've never heard this before.
He deregulated airplanes and beer, and I think we owe him a debt of gratitude.
And trucking. Well,
Yeah, Andrew, you know what you just said? I can translate it for you. It's, I didn't read the Declaration of Independence, How Libertarian Politics Can Fix What's Wrong in America, because it's an entire chapter.
I did read it.
You just didn't read it closely.
I did read that, and I'm aware that you both wrote it. But he had some deregulatory elements to his presidency, but I don't think there's any real...
I mean, like anything that happened pretty much happened under him.
Go,
including the savings and loan.
I just want to say also that we have a revisionist Jimmy Carter obit in the bag that I've been waiting to run for like 18 months now. So I would maybe actually what I want to do is have a drink with him and poison
his
drink.
Say what,
so that we can run this.
How does the lead to that obit change depending on how he dies? So like if it's autoerotic asphyxiation, you know, he's found in a Pyongyang.
That's how it's written right now. We don't have to change it at all if that's what it is.
At the David Carradine suite.
Wow, that
Pyongyang.
I am so impressed with this softball question led us to. I'm gonna use those a lot more moving forward, just to
Before you guys get into Andrew. Go see the clip of and read the transcript of, I believe, the only debate between Ronald Reagan and Jimmy Carter in that presidential season, because it absolutely scrambles everyone's modern conceptions of both men. Whereas Carter talked about, brags on all the deregulations that they've done, but then talks about how we need to do it in, I think, financial services and this and that. And he starts listing all the other things that he really wants to deregulate in a debate with Ronald Reagan. And then meanwhile, Ronald Reagan spends many paragraphs talking about the importance of equal rights for women. And that's just, we don't think about either one of those people in that terms. And it's a sign that we should reexamine our own choices, mostly Nick's.
I love how obsessed you are with that debate, Matt. It's like, do you do an annual reading by candlelight of that
it's
debate?
It's like Bloomsday.
That shit comes up with you so much.
Of DC,
and yeah. I get it. I mean, I read it at your urging. I read it, and it is indeed fascinating. But the Welshian intensity.
It's great that Anderson is also there, and that, you know, Carter, like all presidents since, refused to debate. I mean, there Ford actually debated Carter once in 76, and it was a disaster for Ford. So Carter was like, I'm not going to do that. And it was basically because Reagan and Anderson had talked ahead of time, and Reagan was charging on Carter. It's the whole question of debates, but the content of them is fascinating. And I wish more Republicans would watch that.
And the other great speech that I always bring up is the second inaugural, so 1979, right after the Proposition 13 passed, of Jerry Brown in California. It is the most libertarian speech you will ever hear a total non-libertarian ever give. It's great.
What did Jerry Brown just do that was good? Something.
He reversed Title IX.
Oh yeah,
California, speech and due process
really?
Rights.
That's right.
For the accused. And he's starting to make a lot of moves that are going back to in the 70s when he was Governor Moonbeam in early 80s. Reason had a fair amount of kind things to say because he was much more, he did not fit into a common Democratic or Republican box, which were different than, as Matt was alluding to, even in, during the presidential race in 1980.
He referred to inflation, I think, as like the stalking white horse of death.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's very poetic. And I agree with that economically as well. The longer I do political media, the less and less enthused I am about having a right-left spectrum. I don't think it's very useful. I think that politics is far more complicated than that. And I think Carter and apparently Jerry Brown are good examples of that. I am going to cap our Jimmy Carter postmortem.
Save everyone,
for the
he's
moment.
Really dead.
We'll make it a regular segment.
It's a pre-mortem, technically, but yeah.
It's a pre-postmortem.
Yes, pre-mortem, yeah. We'll move on to the Republican Party and the infighting therein. Former White House strategist Steve Bannon is leading what he calls a season of war against the establishment wing of the Republican Party. He is attempting to find primary opponents for all but one of the Senate Republicans running for re-election next year. I think Ted Cruz is the only senator that has managed to evade his wrath. Mitch McConnell is, of course, not enthused about this and says that they are specialists in nominating people who lose in reference to Bannon and his insurgency. And Bannon is flying around the country trying to raise money from Republican donors to oust the establishment wing of the party and get rid of McConnell and bring his own people in. And Trump, from my vantage point, seems to be sort of nominally supporting a detente, but isn't doing anything to really restrain McConnell or Bannon as they fight each other. Catherine, I'm gonna kick it to you. Let's say that Steve Bannon wins and he's able to get rid of all these establishment Republicans and bring in his own populist fire breathers. What happens with the Republican agenda in the Senate at that point?
Does the Senate have a Republican agenda at this point? I mean, I think
I don't know. I mean, I feel like they agree to some extent, like Trump and the populists and McConnell agree on deregulation and apparently tax cuts. I don't know if the populists came in, if it would lurch a different direction.
Yeah, I mean, if we're taking fucking Roy Moore as
Judge
an
Roy
example
Moore. Judge
of
Roy Moore.
This.
Come on, he's like Judge Reinhold.
Judge Roy Moore.
Judge.
His honor.
Although he did get stripped of
yeah.
that three times, though, didn't he? I think the third time around you can
you
actually drop
judges,
you know, at some point
judges
it just becomes,
are named by God, I think, especially Roy Moore.
He's like a Kentucky colonel. Like, it doesn't, you know. But no, I mean, if Roy Moore is an example of the kind of person we're talking about, this is, and if the Republican establishment's reaction to Roy Moore is an example of how they will be received, I think it's actually quite likely that even the fanciest, most successful Bannon revolution still winds up with a Republican Party that looks annoyingly familiar, and it would be annoying to everyone for various reasons. You know, we saw a welcoming into the bosom of Roy Moore by a lot of Republicans that I personally had hoped would be petulant children and like not sit with him at lunch or something at least. But the idea of being able to turn the party inside out by scampering around the country and finding all these candidates, it feels a little Bill Kristol, David French to me. Like, it's not clear who he's going to find that is going to be up to the job at this point. And I think there could be quite a few sort of embarrassing failures there. But I actually think the real answer here is the Republican Party has always had capacity for this type of person, this type of sort of Bannon populist candidate, and it will stretch to accommodate them and might not look too terribly different from what we have today.
Matt, you know, Catherine brings up that there are these different wings of the Republican Party, and there used to be other wings that are now non-existent. Like, I don't think the term Rockefeller Republican is used in any meaningful sense anymore. And there used to be Blue Dogs as well, who are also functionally non-existent. Is this kind of internal displacement fairly normal in the political cycle?
Well, I mean, Bannon following the Tea Party blueprint of 2009, 10, 11, and 12, where they use the primarying process to reshape the Republican Party in an allegedly more fiscally conservative direction. And it was largely successful. I mean, that's where we get the Rand Pauls of the world and Mike Lee and a bunch of other people.
Marco Rubio.
Come out of even Rubio, who hasn't exactly been the world's biggest fiscal con since he came in. But part of it, they took over kind of comportmentally establishment or squishes type of candidates, as you know, as well as hitting on fiscal conservatism. It's no accident that this drive is getting a lot of notice, particularly right now at a time when the kind of Tea Party pendulum that began in earnest with the grassroots protests in 2009, I think I'm ready to declare it dead as of last Thursday at around midnight, when the Senate passed a 10-year budget resolution, which is a precursor to attempt at tax reform. And there was only one Republican voting no, who was Rand Paul, and the House, where you have more of, you know, fired up, allegedly, you know, fiscal cons and Freedom Caucus and all that kind of stuff. They signal like, yeah, we're cool that we don't need to go to conference committee. We're all good. Even though the agreement blows up the deficit by $1.5 trillion, it includes $4.1 trillion in spending this year. It has numbers for military spending and defense spending that everyone recognizes as outright fiction, because it's going to be $150 billion more than all of that. The only bits in it that even nod towards fiscal restraint, everyone recognizes are going to be obliterated when they act as a real budget going forward. So there is no government cutting or deficit anymore in that wave of the Republican, a makeover via the primarying process. So it's an apt time for thick-headed populism to come in. And some of it's going to be populism, and some of it's just going to be, what is your comportment vis-a-vis Donald Trump? If he farts in this direction and the wind blows there, are you going to say it smells sweet or it smells sour? That is going to have as much to do with things as it is whether you are anti-trade and other things, although I'm sure this will be important too. And I think it's going to make, I mean, I don't bemoan the demise of Rockefeller Republicans. I think you can argue that maybe Susan Collins is one now. But what I do bemoan is the death of the Jeff Flake Republican. People who are actually not comportmental fire breathers or anything like that. Just kind of sober, thoughtful types who will speak their mind on things. Basically, there's about five libertarians on Capitol Hill or strong libertarian leaders. He's one of them. And you can go the Flake or Justin Amash route, and Amash is much more principled and all this kind of much more libertarian. But you can go their route and speak your mind when your mind says speak, and you will become Donald Trump's enemy. Or you can go Rand Paul, Mike Lee, and they both speak their mind sporadically and periodically, including on that vote, but they also find ways to say, Roy Moore, sure, I'm on. You know, they find symbolic ways, or even, you know, a Thomas Massie happy to call the Russia investigation a witch hunt and these kind of things. There's a interesting piece in Axios about how Rand Paul has become the Trump whisperer there by selectively finding kind of low-paying ways to support the president. He gets to keep playing golf with him, and then he gets to help him write executive orders on healthcare. But it forces you to make that compromise. I'm going to miss if Jeff Flake loses, and I don't think he will, but it's a really tenuous and increasingly untenable position to be a liberty movement Republican, I think. And that speaks very badly for the Republican Party. And it makes people who are committed to those ideals have to constantly weigh them against the unnerving popularity of an authoritarian-minded president.
But
hasn't this been true, though, for at least the last 20 years? I mean, I'm thinking about, you know, by a rough estimate, about how many folks could you say on the Hill are more or less libertarian, at least in some significant way? And I think the answer is always like somewhere between 5 and 15. And maybe whether you're closer to 15 or closer to 5 matters. But, you know, when I was an intern at Reason and Mike Lynch, the D.C. bureau, took me up to the Hill and we interviewed all the people who were leaving because they'd been term limited. It was the same folks, first of all, actually literally the same people, some of them, Jeff Flake, for instance.
You could do it all in half an afternoon.
Well, but right? So, yeah,
you
we
know,
did it.
There weren't that many.
You know, yeah. We did the rounds and there were truly some principled libertarians. There were also some temperamental libertarians in that crowd, just people who were kind of leave me alone types who are always a healthy thing to have in the mix.
Hold on,
I think.
Just to clarify, a temperamental libertarian would be just a get off my lawn type personality?
Yeah, you know, it's just like leave me the fuck alone, as opposed to like, I think we should reduce our dependence on, you know, and I think, you know.
And then there was Helen Chenoweth.
Helen Chenoweth Haig.
Great singer.
Helen Chenoweth Haig, who I caught up with her many years later, and she literally said the sentence. I said, like, oh, what are you doing now? And she said, oh, I mostly just cook breakfast for the ranch hands. Anyway, amazing. But, like, there's, you know, there's 5, 10, 15 of them, and they're always around, and they're doing their part to hold down this chunk of the Republican Party. Are they really more in peril than they've ever been? Are they really? I mean, I guess I'm genuinely asking, but it seems to me like there's always this little crowd, and they kind of they're always struggling.
How about thinking about it this way? Because we, you know, Andrew, you started by asking about the civil war in the GOP, and you know, Bannon loves to talk in those terms. From a libertarian perspective, and I think this is the harsh learning curve that libertarians. I think Reason was there first or much earlier, but the Republican Party is not at all libertarian. And to the extent that there are people like Justin Amash or Rand Paul or Ron Paul before them, they were, you know, they were not, you know, they were a small part of the Republican Party, but they were not in any way representative. And we need to change the Republican Party. The Republican Party genuflects and you know, poses for a second and seeks, you know, says certain scriptural terms about, oh, you know, we want to reduce the size, scope, and spending of government while they are increasing the size, scope, and spending of government. You know, and this is inescapable. I mean, Bush and a Republican Congress jacked up spending by 50% over, you know, in real inflation adjusted dollars. And then beyond spending in terms of regulation, he passed massive historic numbers of significant, economically significant regulations on the economy, you know, with a Republican Congress. So, you know, we need to get past the idea that the Republican Civil War is that there's a libertarian faction in it. And I think what we need to be looking at is what the Republican Party, in a way, has never been more successful as, you know, in history. It has more state legislatures, more assembly seats, more governorships, more people in Congress. It's got the White House. It's about to be able to set the course of the judiciary for, you know, the next 10 or 20 years. They are not libertarian, and we need to figure out how to either pull them in a libertarian direction or cut them down so that what comes next, you know, whether it's in the Republican or Democratic Party, is actually more interested in limiting government. And, you know, because we're, you know, why would we pretend that Mitch McConnell or Judge Roy Moore doesn't want to cut the size, scope, and spending of government. Populists don't. Bannon doesn't. Trump doesn't. Mitch McConnell, if he did, you know, then he should be ashamed of himself. Same thing with Paul Ryan. These are not small government people. They want a different type of government control.
They're anti-tax. Like, they do give quite a lot of lip service to tax and will probably reform it, but they're not actually in favor of cutting spending, which I think is something that was very much absent from the budget they had. I'm with you. I don't really
I was working as a Democrat when the Tea Party came in, and I like a lot of the people they produced in terms of elected officials, but I see it as sort of this weird temporary coalition of populists and libertarians, and that it had this sort of tiny government agenda, but it was sort of, it had a lot of volume and oomph to it that I think the populists provided. But from the outside looking in, like I'm an independent, but I think I would at this point fit in better with pro-market Democrats than I would with the Republican Party, just because they do seem to be.
But who are they? I mean, do they exist? I'm not saying that cynically.
Well, I mean, aren't neoliberals kind of the pro-market wing of the party? I don't know that they're.
But who are they?
Ah, in terms of elected officials, I don't know. I know a lot of folks on the Hill, and I know weirdly a bunch of comedy writers that are previously politicos. They tend to do, you know, more of a, or tend to be more of the robust open markets are good. But in terms of elected officials in favor of it, I don't know.
That's the problem.
Yeah. Well, I guess I'll remain a lonely independent who is temperamentally moderate, which is not the best place to be. Going back to the budget, Matt, that you brought up, does there tend to be an actual dependable correlation between tax cuts and economic growth, or is that just a Republican talking point?
Oh, I think Nick has a better handle on that historical thing. I think for sure right now, it's the only kind of magic beans that Republicans have left when they're talking about the debt and deficits. They're just assuming that cutting taxes, and I don't think there's much reform that's going to be left on the table here. They might allow for full expensing on investment, which would be great, I think. And they will, you know, cutting corporate tax rates in a sense can be a reform. But I think a lot of the ending the loopholes will disintegrate on contact with the actual political process and negotiating. If you cut corporate tax rates significantly and manage to get a lot of repatriation of income of U.S.-based corporations by no longer taxing their overseas income, if that money comes back, it can definitely help growth. But as Nick has expertly written on any number of occasions, debt itself dampens growth. And this is a pretty consistent finding along the economics profession spectrum. If you get beyond 90% of GDP with your total state indebtedness, it starts to have a measurable impact downwards. We're already beyond that number right now with the long-term entitlements coming to bear. And there's no evidence at all that, and there's a lot of anti-evidence that Republicans, now that they have power, are interested in cutting any. They've given up. I mean, they've said, well, there's no real passion. There's no political will to cut spending. So that cutting taxes is all we have. So, of course, they're going to say, yes, this will magically erase the deficit on its own. I don't think that it will. And I think that the chances of us being even more in debt 8 years from now, assuming Trump runs that the country the whole time, are excellent, are fantastic. Just in the way that George W. Bush doubled the size of the national debt, and then Barack Obama did, and you know, they and their congresses that they had did. I would look towards that being more likely than anything else.
Yeah, you know, the Republican budget includes growth assumptions of about 2.6% economic growth year over year on average for the budget cycle, which is ridiculous. Nobody else. Is talking about anything more than 2% growth. And that's really kind of being optimistic based on recent history. So there, you know, the amount of magic asterisks where spending is cut, but it's not actually spelled out is very troubling. So is the fact that this is going to be done through reconciliation, which without going into detail means that all of the proposed cuts will be pretty much taken out of the final budget bill. And you have like a fake, growth estimate. These are not good signs going into a budget down the road. And in terms of the tax plans, you know, part of the problem in the United States is we've gotten away from the idea that taxes are the money we use to buy government services. And we keep shifting more and more people off of tax rolls. I mean, already so that, you know, about half of the people in the country are in households that don't pay any federal income tax. Trump's cuts would actually increase that. And of course, you know, people on the left say, oh, you know, he's giving, you know, tax cuts to millionaires and stuff. Yeah, if you want to cut taxes, you have to go to the people who are paying taxes. But it would be far better at this point to try, I guess I'm a total broken record on this. We just as we haven't had serious conversations about the foundations and the principles of foreign policy, we need a national conversation about what's America's role in the 21st century, because we can't do everything. What are the top three priorities that we should have in foreign policy? In terms of tax policy, in terms of spending policy, we have been avoiding these conversations like the plague. And, and we're getting to a point where we're running out of runway on, these old inherited collections of coalitions and parties and policy ideas. Like, cutting taxes again, that's not going to erase the deficit. And it may not even, businesses don't have trouble raising capital right now. Something else is going on. People don't want to invest in the future of the country, partly because we know that the more you cut taxes now while increasing spending, something big is going to happen down the road. There's going to be a moment of reckoning, and you don't want to be, you want to have a lot of cash when you're doing that. It's very frustrating.
I agree. Catherine, can I ask you a sweeping historical question?
Shoot.
So going back a little bit to the various factions that are dominating the Republican Party and fighting among them, which I sort of loosely view as establishment versus populist, one of the things that really surprised me about the 2016 election was how non-ideological most voters were. And I think that we in the media oftentimes kind of get into the habit of thinking that everybody's ideological, but we're not. It seems to me tribalism is a very big part of the political cycle right now. Do you think that just that sort of yay my team, boo your team is the same as it's always been? Do you think it's increasing or ebbing? Or where do you see us in terms of that tribal identity?
I think the awareness of the power of tribalism among elites is increased. And so that can feel the same as actual tribalism increasing, but I don't think that's true. I think this election showed in particular intellectual conservatives and right-wing ideologues that they had less power than they thought and that identity politics had more power. And it's funny because those same intellectuals were complaining about how influential identity politics have become on the left. They were seeing it as a pernicious force in our politics. They were correct in their diagnosis. They missed that it was happening at the rate and with the rate and ferocity in their own party as well. And that's why we had this whole like, oh, my God, Trump won. How did that happen? Problem. The idea that we are othering people, to use a ish-ish neologism. We are othering people less than we ever have been. I think this is we talked about this a little bit earlier in the podcast, but I think it feels more urgent because we're talking about it in a different way. But the idea that we are having, I think we're just seeing more clearly what's always been there. And the Republican Party, and in particular the Republicans that libertarians tended to talk to, the kind of Frank Meyer fusionist, intellectual, New York-y, D.C.-ish Republicans, they sounded okay to us on this identity politics question, and I think believed their own rhetoric about it a little more than they should have. And this election was just a bursting of that bubble.
Okay. Well, I'm going to stop us there for this week and go get a six-pack and track down Jimmy Carter. But thank you, everyone. Good chat as always. This has been The Reason Podcast. I'm Andrew Heaton. Please subscribe to us on iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. And if you have suggestions for topics, tweet us at Reason using the hashtag ReasonPodcast.